Thank you for tuning in to our podcast, History's Top 3, brought to you by the History Department of the United States Naval Academy, located in Annapolis, Maryland. In this show, we will discuss and debate some of the key turning points, trends, and major figures of world history. Our goal is to explore the varied landscapes and seascapes of the past in the hopes of shedding some light on the way the present world came to be. In our studio today, we have three co-hosts, myself, Major Ben Brewster, Mr. Lawrence Nelson, and Mr. Ross Phillips. All of us are PhD candidates at Texas A&M and lifelong students of history. We're also all Aggies. In this new season of Top 3, each of us will present our top choice for today's theme, which is underrepresented or appreciated Marine Corps operations. We will then discuss how we made our choices and why we believe they deserve a place in the Top 3. We invite you to share your thoughts and engage in the discussion. So, let's get into it. I'm Major Ben Brewster. Like we said, I teach history here at the Naval Academy, and I'm excited to be around the microphones again with you two fellow Aggies. Lawrence, over to you.
Right on. Lawrence Nelson, PhD candidate at Texas A&M, currently working for Center of Military History under the Army, doing projects on Afghanistan, but previously done a lot of research on early U.S. Marine Corps expeditionary warfare. Happy to be here as well.
Ross Phillips, PhD candidate, Texas A&M, Giggum. The Gridley Fellow at the Marine Corps History Division Archives and with the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation. My research is on the Marine Corps withdrawal from Vietnam. That'll play into my choice today, so it's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Awesome. Well, let's get into it. Hey, so in terms of top three underrepresented or underappreciated Marine Corps operations, I'm leading off today with the Marine campaign on the island of Samar, 1901 to 1902. So part of the Philippine War. And what's remarkable about this operation and this campaign really on the island of Samar is it's largely remembered today for a legacy of U.S. troops, particularly Marines, summarily executing Filipino guerrillas, and really remembered as a blot on the legacy of the U.S. Army and the Marine Corps. But one of the things that we're going to talk about today is the specific operations that happen in this campaign really shape and set up the Marine Corps that then goes on to fight in the Caribbean during the Banana Wars. There are a couple figures that come out front and center in Samar. You have Major Littleton Waller, who is the leader of the Marine Corps regiment that lands in Samar, really to fight a pacification campaign after an army unit is overrun by rebels and a local village in the southern portion of the island. And Major Waller sets about really with a bushwhacking campaign to push his Marines into the jungle's interior and to root out the rebels, particularly at a place called the Shohatan Cliffs, where there's a combined riverine and overland operation where Major Waller, Captain Porter, and Captain Barris lead an expedition and really is a phenomenal example of small unit tactics and audacity and daring to assault these cliffs that tower 100, 150 feet over the river and root out the last vestiges of the rebels here on Samar. Following that, Major Waller then leads his force on really a march throughout their area of operations, swinging down along the southern coast of Samar and then back from the eastern coast to the western coast. And what becomes known as the Long March from Lanang to Beezy, and what ends up happening is the expedition really ends up getting stuck in the middle of the jungle. They forget to calculate, or they don't accurately calculate the supplies that are needed, and then there's still some dispute in the scholarship over what actually happens while everyone's out of the jungle. But what is for certain is that this expedition splits into three groups. Flying column goes for help under Major Waller, and then they leave the main party, who are too sick or injured to continue to move, under the command of a lieutenant in the middle of the jungle, at which point the local porters who are helping them apparently turn on them, or at least are hoarding food. So this all spirals out of control. Once the army comes out to rescue them, and pulls them out of the jungle, the consequence or the fallout from this is that Major Waller orders the execution of the porters who are along for the movement, basically for turning on the Marines, and it really serves as a blight on the Marines' time there. But a number of the personalities that participate in the Samar campaign then continue on into the Caribbean.
Littleton Waller commands the original intervention of Marines in 1980 and 1915, which begins in late July after another government falls in just absolute chaos as the president, President Sam, is massacred by a group of civilians who parade his body pieces around town. And then the Marines are sent in to stabilize the situation. Waller leads what eventually becomes the 1st Provisional Brigade, which eventually is able to spread out all over Haiti and mostly controlling the port cities around the edges. Because the Cacos have control of the interior and begin to cut off cities from interior supply, he sends Smedley Butler into that interior on long-range patrols in order to break up the Caco or Caco camps and guerrilla forces. And in this part of the country in Haiti, it's hot. It's very mountainous, and it's very hard to penetrate. There's not a lot of communications. There's not a lot of effective trails, and so these patrols are actually highly difficult. It's like Lewis and Clark while getting shot at. It's very difficult to penetrate the terrain. At one point, Smedley Butler, one of his long-range patrols, almost dies in a flash flood. And they eventually make it to a town and just fall asleep in the middle of town. So it's very difficult, very arduous, but what they end up doing is they end up splitting the Marine Corps forces in the area, which is about a regiment size, into lots of different flying columns of about a company size, and they start crisscrossing the region one section at a time. They use the Grand Riviere or the big river there in the middle to section out the two halves of the mountainous region and patrol one section and make contacts, try and drive the rebels out of that region, and then they do the same to the other, all culminating in the battle at the Fort Grand Riviere, which is attacked headlong by Smedley Butler and his men, and they end up annihilating the entire garrison. It's the one really successful operation in the campaign because the rest usually end with the Cacos retreating and escaping without taking very many casualties. But after these casualties, the message or the information of these casualties get back to the United States, the Secretary of the Navy gets very nervous and asks them to stop offensive operations. And they decide to just garrison the countryside and lightly patrol it after this point. For the rest of the campaign, it's a state-building operation. And so they use... They assign Smedley Butler to run the Gendarmerie, which is the local constabulary that is supposed to end up taking control of offensive operations away from the U.S. Marine Corps after they get sufficiently trained. They're also running a lot of actual physical infrastructure building programs. And unfortunately, Smedley Butler makes a choice at this point that is not terribly effective. What he does is he uses the old corvée system, which is a system of taxation through labor, where you take someone who can't afford to pay physical like taxes with money and have them work for a certain amount of time a year on infrastructure projects. Haiti being a country that escaped from white slavery, French white slavery, and is very proud of that fact, it doesn't look very good to have an American Marine standing over a group of Haitian men doing a work project where they're not getting paid. So it didn't look good, and it really riled up the population. And there were some abuses that were committed. And even though that system was shut down a few years after it began, it helped bring about the second revolt of the Cacos, which takes place in 1919. Which is only put down after certain leaders are eliminated through aggressive patrolling and really some impressive work by NCOs who are assertive in their own right and take on operations more or less of their own volition and on their own initiative to track down CACO leaders and eliminate them. And once those leaders are eliminated, they're able to essentially pacify the region. The big thing that comes out of this, the important sort of what's the influence here, it changes the way the Marine Corps wants to do counterinsurgency operations in the Caribbean. They get much more concerned with the perception of the American public and the local public wherever they are and the behaviors that they're doing. And it becomes enshrined in doctrine in the Small Wars Manual, which is written based off of the Marine Corps experiences in the Caribbean. And so you see very different behavior in Nicaragua than you do in Haiti because of the lessons learned that happened much earlier in Haiti than in the second operation that takes place in Nicaragua from 27 to 33. So it's really important in that sense that they learn this really big lesson. And sometimes it's to their benefit, sometimes it's not.
Wow. So we've jumped over World War One from one small war in Samar in the Philippines to the Caribbean. Let's go ahead and jump over World War Two and transition to the Marine Corps' attempt at trying to figure out how to do its next engagement in small wars. Ross, over to you.
Yeah, so my pick for the operations we're talking about is Operation Taylor Common, which was a 1st Marine Division operation from December of 1968 to March 1969. And so it's an effort by the 1st Marine Division to kind of neutralize a VC and NVA base area 112, which is kind of just west of Da Nang out towards the in the Anwa Basin. And so it's kind of conducted in three phases, kind of an initial setup and then two phases of sweeping. And so they're really trying to kind of clear out the area, but also establish more of a presence in the area. And so they kind of, as they progressively sweep through the area, they're going to install these different bases and fire bases, which is an interesting kind of mode of operation, which is kind of in contrast to the 3rd Marine Division, which is operating towards the Laotian border in northern I Corps, and that usually gets a lot of the praise for its operational approach of high mobility, where they're going to go into areas that they don't really have a presence established, and they're going to try to select fire support bases beforehand and then sweep through the area, and then they will kind of retract from the area when they think that the mission is done. And so I think in this case, the 1st Marine Division, the way they're operating actually is, in my opinion, maybe not getting its due, I guess, in a way. I think it actually is somewhat worth a second look as far as trying to project a presence to kind of interdict enemy movement and infiltration, whereas this other kind of operational approach is usually praised for being able to do that. I think that Operation Taylor Common really deserves a second look. And it also features a kind of a rare occurrence of Marine Corps and ARVN, Army of the Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnamese Army cooperation, which is something that the Marine Corps kind of struggles with throughout the conflict. And I see a lot in my dissertation research from 1969 to 1971. There really is kind of minimal coordination at that level. The Marines are much more focused on kind of local security, like the CAP program and regional and popular forces. And so I really think that Operation Taylor Common should be looked at more closely and should kind of be given kind of its due as far as being a successful operation within the context of the Vietnam War for the Marine Corps.
Well, Ross, thanks for that. It seems like, as we've mentioned, these three kind of undervalued operations, there are a couple themes that seem to emerge. One, saturation of an area through just deliberate on-the-ground, methodical patrolling, beating the bush. Working with indigenous forces, partner forces in Samar, even though it's a really limited role, it's still a critical interaction because of the political ramifications it has. But I'm curious, maybe Lawrence, to ask you. You mentioned that the successfulness of the Marine campaign actually had a reverse effect of its desire at the political level, and you said the Secretary of the Navy really said, "Hey, we got to cut this out." You mind talking about that for a little bit? Because I'm curious to hear how that may interact with sometimes the tactical and operational approach doesn't have the desired effect sometimes at the political level, which then can undercut the actual effectiveness of Marines in the field. So why was it that the Secretary of the Navy kind of told the Marines to chill out a little bit?
Yeah, Secretary of the Navy Daniels, Josephus Daniels, who's famous for replacing alcohol rations on Navy boats with coffee. That's why we call it a cup of Joe. It was a political operator more than anything else. He'd written really important and edited really important Democratic newspapers for a long time, and Wilson put him in that position in part because of his support for the campaign. So Josephus Daniels is very much thinking about, well, how is this going to impact the Wilson administration? How are people going to perceive the deaths of Haitians who, by the way, are fighting with outdated muskets with bullets that don't even fit inside the chamber and machetes being mowed down by automatic weapons and effective rifle fire by Marines? How is that going to impact the perception of the United States abroad and at home? And so that's his primary concern, whereas Waller and Butler are thinking about, how do we stabilize this country on the ground and get these bad actors, if you will, to essentially cease and desist? They want to overawe these folks. They know they can't eliminate everybody, but they know if they beat enough of them in the field, they eliminate them and scare them enough, they will stop operating openly. And they can essentially say, job done, move on. So it does have a negative impact. They did have a plan to continue operations in that area and continue to push the Cacos out of that region, and had to immediately stop in late November of 1915 because of the communication from the Secretary of the Navy. And as I said, this impacts very much that moment and the Corvée moment. It impacts very much the way the Marine Corps tries to operate in the future, thinking about, well, what is the political impact that we're having on the ground? And it does make some leaders, not all leaders, but some Marine Corps leaders more tentative to launch aggressive offensive operations. And that tends to fall on young junior officers and NCOs who have to take the initiative and actually do those operations that are necessary in the field to create stability when they're not necessarily getting the support to do those things. So it ends up creating some problems on the ground for the young Marines who actually have to create some stability. But there's always this counteraction in American counterinsurgency where the American public doesn't want its soldiers and Marines and sailors to be killing what seem to be defenseless rebels. But we also want stability on the ground. And so it becomes this issue where the Marines can't really produce the exact situation that the American public want without breaking one of the others. And so it's a darned if you do, darned if you don't problem.
It's fascinating to me as I think about that, only because I wasn't aware of that dynamic, but it speaks to the Marines' actions on Samar, because the Marines are specifically sent in 1901 under Waller because the army that was garrisoned on Samar couldn't handle the situation. And in fact, there's an army company, I alluded to it earlier, they'd been overrun by the rebels, and it in the American press was being reported as the army doesn't have the ability to control the Philippines and certainly not Samar, so they send in the Marines. Waller gets after it at the tactical level, and his operation at the Sohatan Cliffs is just a phenomenal example of, they say, hey, we know where the rebels are. We beat them back into the inland area. And so they devise a scheme where Waller's going to lead a riverine force on boats. He's going to paddle up the river. And then he's going to send Captain Porter and Captain Barris. And Barris here, Hiram Iddings Barris, and they called him Hiking Hiram because he could just move, and that was his reputation. Fun plug here, also a graduate of Norwich University, my undergrad alma mater, and a Corps of Cadets rivalry to the Naval Academy, the Brigade of Midshipmen here, which I have great fun teasing the midshipmen in my classroom about. But anyway, Hiking Hiram leads the overland movement up to the Choatan Cliffs over one period of darkness. He leaves the coastal town of Beezy. Waller is paddling up the river, and the instructions are they're going to meet in a pincer movement as the sun comes up. The sun comes up. Waller isn't there with the boats, and Barris and Porter essentially make a decision as junior officers to say, we're going to attack the cliffs from the rear, take the cliffs. And then they also, they scrounge some boats to get across the river themselves, and it ends up being highly successful. Waller takes that tactical success and then essentially goes traipsing around the island to make sure that he is completely in control of his area of operation to do exactly what the American people, exactly what his chain of command, and probably for this fight, most importantly, what the American press expected the Marines to do. But then he ends up in a circumstance where their initiative outran their judgment. They end up on this long march scenario. And if you're an American commander in the Philippines with a lot of scrutiny by the American press, and you end up losing part of your command due really to starvation, exposure, and abandonment on the trail, you can't necessarily cover that up by summarily executing a squad's worth of local porters and blaming it on them. What is most interesting to me out of all this is how it plays in the press, is that when Waller is brought back to the United States and he goes through a court-martial, it then comes out in his defense that part of his original tasking from the Army leadership was, I want you to make Samar howl, right? I want you to make it this waste, this burning wilderness. And when Waller asks for clarification, he's told by the Army leadership, oh, you can kill anyone over the age of 10. What's most interesting, and a scholar named Brian Lynn has brought this out, all of us have studied under Dr. Lynn down at A&M, Waller never seemed to protest this order before he was in the circumstance of being held to account for his summary execution of these porters. So he didn't necessarily have an issue with it until the American public had an issue with the way he was prosecuting the campaign. And then he pulled this get out of jail free card, which said, hey, the army general told me that these were kind of the rules we were playing under. Ultimately, Waller continues on in the Marine Corps. He doesn't end up becoming the commandant because he has this blot on his record. Not necessarily tactically, but politically, he spoiled goods. Ross, any thoughts from your perspective, either you know, with Marine actions in Vietnam, press, public reaction, or just a view towards how initiative and daring at the tactical level maybe don't have the operational or strategic impact that the Marines on the ground would expect they would have?
Mm-hmm. I think kind of your point to the saturation and then kind of how initiative and things like that play into it, I think that's an interesting thing to think about when trying to, within the context of operations like Taylor Common or maybe Dewey Canyon, where they kind of talk about, it's basically the problem of how do we stop infiltration or how do we saturate an area to make sure that an enemy doesn't use it as for sanctuary or something like that. I think all of these kind of cases speak to that issue. And I know for in my case, it was kind of a, how can you take a smaller force, multiply that force in order to be in all these places at once? And it's kind of it's an interesting debate to think about as far as how do you kind of adequately saturate that area? How do you apply force within areas that are populated? All of these kind of have an element of also how do you keep the enemy from the people too, which is really interesting.
Well, I think we've had the opportunity to see kind of different aspects of each one of these operations and maybe how they haven't been remembered, but whether that's due to press coverage at the time, a historical understanding of it in the scholarship since, or just an institutional bias towards wanting to remember one type of operation over another. All three of them certainly lend themselves to being under-remembered or underappreciated operations. Well, appreciate you all coming back up. And as always, there's plenty more to debate on the subject, but we'll save that for a round of drinks for later. From all of us here at the United States Naval Academy, particularly the History Department, thank you for tuning in.
Whoop and giggle.
All right.
This has been a production of the History Department at the U.S. Naval Academy, located in Annapolis, Maryland. If you enjoy our programs, please let us know, as we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at USNA History, and our email is historyproductions-group@usna.edu. For more information about the History Department at the Naval Academy, please visit usna.edu/history.